Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now, as they do every week, is our roundtable, Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in sunny Washington, D.C., Brian Canfield, the executive director of the Pacific Northwest Aerospace Alliance, will join us later in the program to discuss COVID's impact on one of the world's leading commercial and military aerospace hubs out there in the sunny Pacific Northwest, and their upcoming 20th anniversary conference that will include Ron, Richard, and me as participants. Gentlemen, it's always good to have you back on the program.
As always, Vago, great to be here. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Vago.
Happy weekend, Vago.
Yeah, that's right. It wouldn't be Sunday if we weren't all talking. So thanks so much for joining us. And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA, our land warfare coverage. Guys, the death toll continues to mount in the United States, hitting 440,000 as vaccinations also pick up speed. Thank goodness Britain has streaked ahead in efforts to inoculate its population, while Europe has lagged. China and Russia obviously supplying vaccines all around the world. We had over the last week the major aerospace and defense names, Boeing, GD, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon Technologies, and many others report 2020 in earnings. And then we had the extraordinary GameStop gamma squeeze that rocked Wall Street, driving it to, I think, Ron, correct me if I'm wrong, worst week since 2008, as hedge funds who failed to adequately hedge found themselves on the receiving end of their own short squeeze tactics. I think what is it, justice? You know, there is some justice in that at the end of the day, but it did drive dynamics on the street. Ron, start us off, right? Talk to us a little bit about the broader market. Right, you know, from GameStop to inflation concerns, you know, more stimulus underway, a debate in Washington on that, as well as how the new administration is going to respond to China and how China is responding to the new administration.
Yeah, there's a lot of topics there. So let's kind of just quickly on the broader market. If you look at the S&P on the week, it was down about 3.5% on the week. When you look at the aerospace stocks, they were mixed, right? I mean, you know, Boeing was down about 5.5%, as was Lockheed. You know, the best performing of the big stocks was Raytheon Technologies. They outperformed the S&P by about 2%. They were only down about 1% on the week. The champ, at least in the companies I look at, was Virgin Galactic. It was up 30% on the week. Again, I'm talking about squeeze trades, that kind of thing. You know, so maybe that's a nice segue into, you know, the situation with and I think it's more than just GameStop. It was, there was a trade going on that heavily shorted stocks got pushed and then forced folks to cover. It's just, you know.
And BlackBerry was part of that, right? American right. Airlines was part of it, and all tied up a little bit.
AMC into, Theaters, into, there was right. a bunch of them. And, you know, it's sort of beyond my pay grade to sort of dig into, you know, the broader ramifications on it, you know, politically or otherwise. But it was just sort of this cover trade happened, and names that were heavily shorted or had reasonable short interests, you know, outperformed on the week. You know, we'll see ultimately where that goes. But it drove a lot of volatility in the market. And, you know, and I think it's not just that. That's one thing. There are worries about lurking inflation, although, to be clear, you know, and the fear there is, you know, with a lot of stimulus, you quote unquote print money, and if you print money, you that can, you know, theoretically maybe drive inflation. But honestly, we haven't done a long time, so that draws a bigger debate around, you know, you look at your debt to GDP in Japan, and their interest rates are really low, and they don't have an inflation problem. You know, what's that mean for the rest of the world? What's it mean for the U.S.? There's a whole, you know, debate around, you know, modern monetary theory and not, you know, trying to stimulate an economy with fiscal policy versus monetary policy. Maybe we could go on for hours about this, but it's one of those things that, you know, I think is, you know, buzzing around the market that people are trying to get, you know, get their head around. And then on China, I think one of the things that we're hearing from investors is a perception, and I'm just saying this as a perception, not as a truth, and not as my opinion, just a perception that maybe, you know, the Biden administration will be softer on China than the Trump administration. And that's driving, I think, some folks to maybe place some bets around, oh, if we're going to be friendlier to China, that's better for A, B, and C. We'll see how that ultimately plays out. You know, there was, I think, an article in Barron's this week that suggested that that actually might be a dangerous way to play, because that might not be how it plays out. But on the conference calls, you know, specifically the Boeing conference call, Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun was more optimistic about China than they had been on a previous call. So we'll see where that all plays out.
So talk to us, you know, we're going to talk about China in a minute, but I mean, we had a lot of earnings and there's a lot of key takeaways. We were all exchanging texts and emails throughout the week on that. Ron, you know, sort of start us off, right, about the group and how they overall performed, and also some of the specific takeaways, right? I mean,
yeah, so I would say this, Vago, when you think about the broad reporting trends, and we had on the week, I think we had close to 15 companies report in my coverage universe, and you know, there was even more, right? I mean, there's a broad swath of companies reporting. I would say a couple things. One, in the aftermarket, we saw a modest improvement. So things were really bad and they were just bad. So, you know, last quarter, they're really bad. This quarter, they're just bad, not like really bad. So, yeah, as a case in point, Raytheon Technologies in their commercial aerospace unit, you know, the previous United Technologies, their aftermarket was down 30%, something like that, instead of being down 50%. And we're hearing mixed numbers like that. You know, aftermarket numbers are, I think, going to be bound anywhere from at the high end, probably down 30% to down 70%. But so it's 50% plus or minus something down. And I think that was broadly expected. On commercial OE, I mean, that's largely on this side of the Atlantic, Boeing really had a quite awful quarter. You know, they took some big charges on the 777X. They pushed out the entry into service of that aircraft. They didn't give a lot of details around when 787 is going to go back into service. They suggested that 787 would, they might, if they're lucky, deliver a couple airplanes in March. They did bring up the phraseology forward loss on 787. And like I've said before in the past, Boeing is sort of like the Fed. They're very deliberate in what they say, and they don't bring up things unless they mean it. So that might be in the cards in the future. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens in the next quarter or two, something like that. Yeah, they did deliver some 737s. They burnt through a bunch of cash. They had a very long conference call. And you know, the things like I would suggest, and you know, just on Boeing for just 1 minute, you know, on the conference call, they said some things like, you know, resilient, we're going to be sharper, we're going to be leaner, we're going to have enduring lasting change, lasting transformational change. But they didn't really address the, you know, the elephant in the room, which is, okay, 737 MAX didn't go well. You're on your second set of difficulties on 787. 777X is giving you difficulties. They took another charge on tanker to the order of another $250 million. 747-8 was at a forward loss right out of the box. Commercial crew hasn't gone very well. And they didn't really address how are they fixing what's going on inside the company? They did admit that they probably have to do another airplane. I think they're kind of shifting on that, but they didn't tell us if they do this other airplane, how are they going to do it? And it doesn't end up in the same category of all the aforementioned programs. So anyway, and then on defense, it was a mixed bag. Northrop had, you know, I think, for a lack of better words, a pretty spectacular quarter. I mean, their backlog build, I think in the quarter was 1.2, 1.3, but they've had many quarters where they've been building their backlog, and you know, the numbers in the quarter were quite good and it was very solid. Lockheed's was, I think, compared to investor expectations, a little bit softer. And, you know, General Dynamics had a fine quarter. In particular, we've talked about this before, Gulfstream seems to be just, you know, flying right along through all the turbulence we have out there. So it was, you know, the defense players was a little bit more of a mixed bag. We're starting to see the services guys report. You know, Booz Allen reported on Friday. And their numbers were a little squishy too. And they were pointing to the change in administration and what that means for contracts. So, you know, defense was a little more murky. And commercial, I think, was a little more predictable.
Sash, give us your sense on the earnings and how you saw some of the numbers and how you interpret, especially Boeing. Richard, I'm going to come to you in a minute because you wrote a great piece in Forbes about the 777X as well. But Sash, start us off on what you make of the numbers that from where you're sitting.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, first point to make is that Europe is 2 weeks behind the US in terms of reporting. So we were able from this side of the pond just to sit back and watch, you know, open the popcorn and just watch the whole process. The Boeing numbers were by far the most interesting, as you rightly point out. And 2 points really that we would make, and I know we were all sort of discussing this over the week, you know, 777X now is remarkable. It's an over 10-year development program. Now, some of that is choices that management has made because the near-term market is not there to support bringing these aircraft in service. Some of that is choices the FAA has made. Some of that is, you know, frankly, technical screw-ups. But, you know, 777X now, it's up there, or should I say down there, with the Chinese C919 and the Russian MS-21, and even, dare I say it, the Mitsubishi MRJ or SpaceJet as, you know, just way out, one of the longest development programs. And hell, it's only a derivative. It's only, you know, just a 777 with new wings. It's not even a new program. So this does make us worried about new programs in this industry, period. You know, whether Boeing, Airbus, or anybody else. Companies have always said, oh, yeah, you know, we can do an aircraft in about 6 years. And I think as analysts, we've tended to think, yeah, right, we'll say seven. But actually, new aircraft programs are nearer to 10 years than certainly than six. Six, I think, is absolute cloud cuckoo land as an estimate of a new aircraft development. I don't think anybody can do it that fast at the moment, particularly given the regulatory issues that have arisen as a result of the 737 MAX problem. And you know, that's something that we feel quite strongly about, that investors have got to be skeptical about claims by management of any civil aerospace company of how quickly they can develop an airframe or an engine, because the record shows that they have been over optimistic for the last 20 years, frankly. Second point, I think that it's just worth highlighting coming out of Boeing is, it's going to take a long time for the, you know, the market with Airbus to stabilize. But it's hard to escape the conclusion that Airbus has had a really good last 2 years because there has been no competition in narrow bodies. You know, Boeing hasn't been delivering 737 MAXes, and investors in Airbus have probably forgotten what it looks like when both companies are trying to deliver narrow bodies to their customers, and particularly when both companies are trying to deliver narrow bodies to the same customer. And, you know, we've counted about 24 significant customers, half of whom are leasing companies, who have got big orders for both the 737 MAX and the A320neo family. They've only had to take A320neos in the last 2 years. In 2021, they're going to have both OEMs trying to stuff them full of aircraft that heaven knows they don't need. And this is what we think is going to cause real strains in the market this year, because the only way you can resolve that issue of too much capacity being forced into a market that has no need for it are price or the buyers just go on strike and just say, we cannot take this stuff, you know, please go away. And if that's the case, then we're going to see production cuts on both sides. Boeing clearly rode back on the commitment to end 2021 at 31 737 MAXes a month. They're now talking about getting to that, I think, in Q1 22. Airbus very, very gently rode back from its commitment to raise the A320 rate to 47 a month. They're now saying 43 a month, possibly getting out to 45. These cuts are going to keep on, we think, this year, and we're going to end up net down on the year.
Richard, talk to us about what you thought was interesting across the piece, and also give us your case on 777X, which in Forbes you wrote, it will be okay eventually. Right.
Can I just say, Vargo, that was a fantastic piece of English understatement. I think, you know, Richard is gradually becoming a sort of acclimatized to being a sort of an honorary Brit, certainly in aerospace terms. But I read that and I thought, yep, you got it.
Sash, you've been both a friend and an inspiration and a mentor on that for the last 20 years. So we all continue to learn.
Yeah, but Richard's a very quick learner.
You know, a couple comments. One, I was sort of interested in Ron's take on the whole inflation aspect. And one thing that I think affects our industry, you look back, it's been a dozen or more years of extremely cheap capital, dirt interest rates. And what do we have? We don't have inflation, we have bubbles. And they're clearly not the same thing. And our industry shows this brilliantly. You know, we've got lots of cash that's piled into third-party finance of jets that resulted back in 2008 of, you know, creating, well, the only healthy manufacturing industry on the planet in the midst of the worst economic meltdown since World War II. That was wonderful, and it's continued. Lots of people love investing in jets. Inflation, quite the opposite. We've become poster children for deflation. As I never tire of saying, the real price of a 320 or a 737 is, a lot less than it was in 2000. As a matter of fact, it's exactly the same in nominal terms as 2000, which means we've been busily losing 1% or 2% of real value per year. That's kind of extraordinary. So the narrative on inflation, I think, might be a little bit off. It promotes bubbles, but in an industry that's figured how to build lots of things cheaply, it doesn't create inflation. We're going to have to see, of course, because we're getting into the realm of very long-term, very cheap capital and lots of it. So who knows? Thanks for mentioning my 777X piece. You know, talk about wrong place, wrong time. I am not with Sash. I'm with him on the understatement. I love it. And it's a style that I seek to emulate. But, you know, what I mean, MS-21, C-919, MRJ, you know, sort of the Francisco Franco of aircraft, still valiantly holding on in its fight to remain dead. I don't see it. You know, 777X, yeah, you know, you've got some technical issues. You've got changing certification requirements. And yes, it is a derivative, a major derivative, but still, I would argue that maybe the thing that kind of demotivates Boeing from really going straight out is that this is in an impossibly wrong place, wrong time. Nobody wants a jet right now in this class. Nobody wants a wide body, period, which is why you've got 87 787s building up looking for owners, like, you know, sad dogs at a dog pound, or waiting delivery or something like that, and probably a similar product in the rest of the twin aisle market. There's as Ron has pointed out, there's a very limited user group for the 777X, and none of them are particularly eager for capacity in any sort, let alone the biggest jet that you can buy today, now that the 380 and 747 are off the market. So my take on it is eventually the process of route fragmentation will reverse itself, and once again, world economies will value belly cargo. And, you know, eventually you'll burn off the overhang of 777-300ER capacity, and this thing will be a success. But it's going to take a long time. And until then, it's not a surprise that they're hardly eager to bring this to market. That doesn't put it in the same class, however, as, you know, planes from people who don't know how to build planes and are, you know, still trying to decide what part of their production line is edible. It's just sort of, I just don't think it's the same thing.
Ron, I know you had a 777X follow-up. Give us your sense on that. And I also just have one quick follow-up about Lockheed's interesting construction at Palmdale. Take it away.
Yeah, sure. On the 777X, what I found interesting, surprising. So they took a $6.5 billion charge. They shrunk, for those accounting wonks out there, the accounting block size. So they're in a forward loss on the airplane now. So that means on a go-forward basis, they're not going to record any gross earnings on the plane. They're in a forward loss, at least in the current accounting block size. And the piece that I think was a real head-scratcher, the $6.5 billion charge, and they attributed a chunk of it to software and actuation. And that's some serious software and some serious actuation for $6.5 billion, right? So maybe to Richard's point, there's more going on than maybe, you know, behind the curtain there than just some software changes and, some other stuff. On the, you know, the Skunk Works building, I don't know, it's fascinating, right? There's been, I think, talk of, you know, potentially it's NGAD or maybe something else or some sort of reconnaissance aircraft. But as we all know, the Skunk Works has a fantastic history of doing some, you know, very fascinating stuff behind a curtain where nobody sees it. And maybe one day we'll learn what they're doing there. But no doubt, it's probably pretty exciting.
That's absolutely true. Richard, you had something you wanted to add?
Yeah, just another point, another milestone in the Boeing's earnings call. They passed $5 billion in KC-46 charges. per Ron's point, yeah, it's, you know, between this space and 777X and God knows what else, this is a company that very badly needs to revisit its, well, the presence of engineers and its management team and so many other factors related to corporate culture.
Do you guys think there are going to be management team changes here at the end of this? I mean, if you're an investor, you're an analyst, or anybody watching this, I mean, I think it's a bit surprising that there haven't been changes. I mean, am I right or wrong?
I would make the point that there really, really should be. That's been glaringly obvious. The fact that it's so obvious and yet it hasn't happened hardly fills you with encouragement about change.
I think you know, Vago, it's one of those things that time will tell. Let's see where you know, the great arbiter, the market, has, you know, Boeing shares in a year. So if we're, you know, a year from now and we are in the midst of a recovery, like we all hope, like, you know, we expect to be, you know, the vaccine thing happens, gets rolled out some form or another, like it is, and maybe accelerates. And so we get into an environment where the economies are healing and people are traveling and maybe even traveling internationally. Let's see where, you know, Boeing is there compared to its peers, the rest of the market, and the rest of, you know, kind of the A&D group. If it is severely lagging the group, then the drumbeat for management change will probably get a lot louder. So I think it's at this point too soon to tell. But, you know, clearly going into this, like we've talked about many times, mistakes made at the Boeing company made the pandemic orders of magnitude worse for Boeing than they were for Airbus.
Sash?
I've got nothing to add to Ron's summary is perfect.
Sash, start us off, right? Your colleague Nick does a great weekly note every Friday looking at the global commercial traffic outlook. We're all vaccine fundamentalists here, as we've said from the very beginning of this pandemic. Right, vaccinations are happening, but there are still a lot of people who are dying and more people who are expected to die. And then we've got uncertainties about the direction of where China goes. Give us your sort of sense on what your model now is for the travel, on the travel side of things, and how you would be factoring in or mentally factor in where we are vis-a-vis, you know, trade, China and the industry. And then Richard, your take, and then Ron, yours.
Okay, great. I mean, I'm 2 points. First of all, the travel numbers, with the notable exception of India, which is actually continuing to recover really impressively at the moment, but everything else, China, Europe, US, Asia and Australia, in the last week was flat to down. And of those, the most worrying is China. China is about 25% down compared to the beginning of the fourth quarter. And if you look at the noises coming out of the Chinese market about bookings for the Lunar New Year, Chinese New Year, which is in February, the Chinese government is saying to citizens stay at home, and a stay at home message from the Chinese government carries a lot of weight. Bookings for the Chinese New Year are down about between 60 and 70% at the moment. That's looking very, very ugly indeed. Here in Europe, we're in the middle of a very, very unedifying, I hate to use the phrase, but vaccine war. The rollout of vaccines in the EU has been much slower than I think people expected or wanted. There have been shortages of vaccines. And although, you know, the process is underway, it's way worse than, you know, probably people expected at the beginning of the year. The standout, you know, and I say this with some surprise, is actually the UK. The UK is, you know, probably about the fourth, fifth best country in the world in terms of the percentage of population that's been vaccinated so far. And this has caused astonishing stress between the UK and the EU, particularly over the last sort of couple of days or so. It's been very unedifying, but it has been absolutely, you know, vociferous. Month's time, 2 months' time, let's hope we've all forgotten about this, and that the availability of vaccines has risen across the board, and that the impact of the vaccination programs is reducing cases and reducing deaths. But at the moment, in Europe, things feel very, very, very stressful indeed. And, there's light at the end of the tunnel, speaking from the UK, but boy, it's a long old tunnel.
And China?
China, as I said, I think China is very interesting, just the degree to which that market has started to turn down again. Because, if you look at how civil aerospace management have been referring to China throughout 2020, Q2, Q3 earnings in particular, as being the, what things look like when a region recovers from coronavirus. Because China got about 70% down in February, March last year in terms of travel, and then recovered to absolutely flat in October. And as I said, it's now about 25% down again. It's a very unpleasant double dip. But really, we've got to be very cautious. We were actually running the numbers for Airbus the other day. China was and is by far Airbus's largest market, 25% without blinking of all Airbus output over the last 10 years has gone to China. But it's starting to turn down now. And interestingly, Chinese leasing companies were the guys who got caught short. They ended up owning a bunch of aircraft at the end of last year that they didn't have customers for. And that suggests that even Chinese airlines are beginning to lack enthusiasm for putting more capacity in at the moment.
Richard, both on vaccinations and COVID and air travel overall, but also not just China's numbers, but the trade dispute and how you think that changes the outlook going forward.
Yeah, just very quickly, first on the issue of the recovery, I still think we're on the floor of the U. I don't think anyone should have any illusions. As you say, we're all vaccine fundamentalists, but it's not going to be a lineup. It's going to be you crawl along until all of a sudden we have the problem licked, and then you make a very, very, very fast recovery. To me, that really begins sometime this summer. Till then, I just don't think you can read month per month and anything. I just don't think it matters. Just close your eyes, get through the next four or five, however many months, and then we enjoy a nice straight ride up. That's my fervent belief. And, China, obviously they've got issues there in terms of, how whether or not there's another outbreak or whether or not there's anything going on. But it's also important to remember that their air travel problems predated the pandemic. Sash says that the lessors there got caught. Well, yeah, they did. But, you had air travel growth slow from 12.2%, I believe, in late 2018 to much less than half of that by late 2019. Nothing to do with the pandemic. There was something going on. And not only that, but in terms of, China's percentage of the world market, as Sash said, they were at about a quarter and they went to about half of that in 2019. Something had clearly happened. So when we talk about a China recovery, are we talking about a recovery to the sort of great numbers that they had shown us in the second half of the last decade? Or are we talking about a return to the mediocre numbers in the late 2020s? And I think the broader problem here is, this debate about President Xi and what he wants from the China economy. In statements to the party and in other places, he's made it very clear that the days of rapid growth, open market, free trade capitalism are kind of ending, and they'll be happy with a kind of good enough, more state managed economy. And that's hardly good from an air travel or jetliner demand perspective. So we're going to have to wait and see how China changes and how we manage it in the West and deal with that. That's going to be a key issue too. And I think it's very important that, this is the thing I look for with the Biden administration. It's important for the West to be on the same page rather than sniping at each other and letting each other fail. And also it's important to give the Chinese an out. It's important to say, okay, here's what we expect and here's what we want. We're going to be strong, but hey, there's so much room, rather than the kind of endless confrontation, the sort of foolish tweets that show, Winnie the Pooh dolls being used as a dog toy. That kind of nonsense needs to end.
And I would point out that since January the 20th, we have not seen any Winnie the Pooh dolls used as a chew toy. Ron, kind of give us your thoughts on that, and then Sash, want to come to you for a defense point before we bring Brian onto the program. Go ahead, Ron.
Yeah, on the vaccine, I don't have a heck of a lot to add. And on China, I think Richard brought up some salient points. The one thing I would add that was in the press, I think it was maybe this week, maybe late last week, sort of a bit of a blur with earnings going on. But COMAC did come out and say, right, their goal is to get their aircraft certified this year, 2021, and that they're going to build a prototype of the C-929. That's the Russian-Chinese widebody. And they'd like to have that prototype built by the end of next year. Quite frankly, both those seem like very, very, very aggressive and probably unrealistic goals. That being said, however, the point on the 919, I mean, has been raised by the investment community, and investors are starting to ask, well, you know, what if they really do that? What does that mean? How much of an impact on the market can that have globally? How much of an impact can it have in China? It's I think it's a matter of when, not if. So something to keep an eye on. And then that, I think, broadly factors into, at least from an aerospace perspective, all the chips on the board, all the, you know, the pieces on the chessboard around the Chinese strategy, right? Because as Richard pointed out, China is a very important end market for both Boeing and Airbus. On the 737 MAX alone, I think it accounts for about a third of the backlog. And as of today, we still don't have a definitive timeline out of China on when the MAX is going to go back into service.
Sash, give us an update on France's sale of Rafale fighters to Greece and any other defense thing that's happened over there or anywhere else that you think is important enough to discuss.
Yeah, we've talked about Rafale lots last year. I think last year was one of the best years for Rafale orders, near orders, general positive news flow on Rafale for, probably the last decade. And what was really interesting last year, Greece came out of almost nowhere and said, yeah, we want Rafale, 18 aircraft. The Parliament finally approved that purchase a week or so ago. And the order is split 12 second-hand aircraft from the French Air Force and six new builds. So they effectively signed, from Dassault's point of view, for six new aircraft. But the French Air Force came back almost immediately. I mean, this happened on Friday, and ordered 12 replacement aircraft. And it's a lovely deal for the French Air Force because they sell on their F3R standard aircraft, and they get brand new F4 aircraft a couple of years down the line out of it. So they're trading out new, getting back new. Trading out an old, getting back new. And it's a very interesting example, first of all, just how joined up the French state and French industry are. The French Air Force is told to deliver 12 aircraft to Greece because the Greeks need them really fast, because they just don't like having Turkey being very aggressive on their doorstep. The French Air Force salutes, turns to the right, and provides 12 aircraft. And the French state immediately orders with Dassault. I can't think of any other country in Europe that would do things that fast, that seamlessly. And this makes France look like a very, very trusted, reliable supplier of aircraft, whether new or secondhand. There are competitions going on, as we know, in Finland. I don't think Rafale's got much of a chance there. Switzerland, much more of a chance. Croatia, they think they've got it. Possibly the UAE, depending on how the F-35 sale goes there. And even Indonesia. We could get another really good year for Rafale this year. And then Dassault's got the high quality problem of working out how to fit all those deliveries in the, for the rest of the decade.
Very quickly, Richard, and then Ron, your sense on the Biden administration's change of tune on UAE as well, right, which has implications for the F-35 as well as precision munitions makers.
Yeah, it's certainly a notable change. I tend to think, it's been a little bit overreported because it's routine to put a pause on things that have just been signed by the previous administration with a certain degree of controversy. I still think the UAE deal will go ahead with the F-35s. TGMs, though, that's an interesting one. The way I would look at this is that I think they're probably going to use this as a way of putting leverage against, or putting pressure on the Saudis And that means you start everywhere else, but say, okay, you've made your promises. You're agreeing to live up to these terms and conditions and make these commitments. How about you, Saudi Arabia? And, you know, that's going to be really interesting because so far, most of the Biden administration's comments about political concerns for the region have focused on, Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia rather than anybody else.
Ron?
Yeah, I second Richard's point. I think the headlines were a little, just kind of too big. It's a pretty standard thing to review this stuff. Right. The UAE thing seems like there doesn't seem to be a ton of controversy there. Saudi, maybe more so. We'll see how it all plays out. But I think the press was maybe putting the cart in front of the horse on this one.
I think the other interesting thing, before we bring Brian on, you know, regarding China is the administration is, I think moving pretty methodically, right? I mean, there was a concern they'd be way too soft on China. They're being tougher on China at the end of the day, right? But this is still early days. And I think the administration is looking at this in a relatively unhurried way. And I think that in turn also puts pressure a little bit on China. So it's going to be certainly interesting to watch as everybody wants to balance, you know, free trade, protect national security, while actually not ending up in a worse situation with a nation that has a kind of unfortunately a reputation for being a bully. On that note, joining us now is Brian Canfield, who is the executive director of PNAA, the Pacific Northwest Aerospace Alliance, that holds its annual conference this year virtually, the 20th anniversary conference, just in about a week and a half. Brian, thanks very much for joining us.
Vago, thanks for having me on the podcast. And it's great to join you again, Richard and Ron and Sash. Nice to meet you.
We're honored to have you, and we very much appreciate that you're one of our listeners, as well as a number of folks up there in the region. Talk to us a little bit about the vibe, right? I mean, we talk about all of this stuff in terms of COVID, its impact, the 737 MAX grounding, the 787 consolidation in Charleston, tanker challenges, 777X challenges, production rate changes. And at the end of the day, you guys are actually living this. I should mention the Advanced Development Center shutdown as well. At the end of the day, you guys are living it. What's the vibe out there as all of this is going on, given that it's actually fundamental to people's ability to do business?
Yeah, no, thanks, Vago. You know, I'd say it's really a mixed bag up here right now. You know, we've become, we're so reliant on commercial aerospace, and it's really the heartbeat of manufacturing here in the Pacific Northwest, and it has been for, you know, over 100 years now. And commercial aerospace, is definitely soft right now with the impacts of COVID and so on. But one of the things that we're seeing is a lot of light, a lot of positive things that are happening here in this region. There are a lot of new growth segments that are really popping up here in the Northwest. Space has really been something, with the likes of Blue Origin and some of the other companies. SmallSat has really exploded here as well. Defense is stable. We've got some other activity with UAM and with electric propulsion. Speaking of which, even just about a week and a half ago, Magni X just opened a new facility, a new headquarters in Everett, Washington. And there's talk of other companies, both commercial and defense, that are talking about moving to the Pacific Northwest. And so with all of the softening of commercial, we're seeing this growth in all these different other areas of aerospace right now. So there's a lot of excitement. I'd say there's also some optimism around some of the positive indicators we're seeing, you know, MAX returning to service, the COVID vaccine that is starting to be distributed, and some of these other indicators showing signs of aerospace returning.
One of the unfortunate stories we've been dealing with on a weekly basis for a long time were the challenges that Boeing has been having. And obviously, it is the biggest player in that ecosystem. Are there concerns when the biggest company in the region and certainly one of the most important companies in the United States appears to be faltering the way it is? I mean, how is your membership coping with that at the end of the day?
I think they're coping with it in different ways. One of the things it's done is it's caused them to have to re-examine how they operate as a company. I mean, look at their finances, look at their function, how lean they are, things along those lines. And surprisingly, I've actually spoke with more aerospace companies here in the last few months that have posted record profits for 2020. And so I think there's actually some positive that's coming out of that. The other positive is with these other growth segments right now, If there is attrition with employees, it's actually allowing those other companies to grow. The nice thing there is that we've got the talent pool that's still here in the Pacific Northwest. It's still vibrant. And when things come back with Boeing, and I know they will, it's going to position the region, I think, even better.
You know, we on the program regularly talk about the need for Boeing to develop a new airplane. Analysts have been calling for that. We've been calling for it. And now we're seeing a reflection that Boeing management is starting to talk about it. Certainly airlines want the company to develop a new product. Is there a lot of expectation? I mean, are folks hopeful that the company is going to go ahead with this decision and it's not just going to end up lifting Boeing, but the whole sector up there?
Yeah, absolutely, Vago. I think that both the airlines and the manufacturing base is looking forward to this new aircraft. And I think one of the things that it does is it provides a lot of inspiration and excitement, really, to be working on something new, something that's going to change history, and something that integrates all this new technology. You know, but certainly above all else, it fuels their businesses. So yeah, I believe that the folks would be looking forward to that new program and hopefully here in the Pacific Northwest.
You know, we talk a lot also about the recovery. You know, at what point do things not just start to normalize, but then the industry fully heal? You guys are actually living this. What's your guys' sense up there, right? I mean, people are making some existential investment and planning decisions. So this isn't a theoretical thing. How do you guys see the turnaround from where you guys are sitting?
You know, I think it is still a little bit challenging to tell where things are going to fall, but one of the things that we have seen is the COVID vaccine is starting to come out, and the folks here are very hopeful that that's going to start to, you know, cycle down the COVID that we're experiencing, and hopefully have things return to normal somewhat. So, you know, as far as the timeline, I think it's anybody's guess, but you know, if this COVID vaccine begins to roll out and it's successful, then you know, perhaps in the second half of the year we should see people returning to air. And that generating demand through the airlines and through the supply chain, and hopefully pick that right back up.
Let me ask about your conference. I know I speak for Ron, Richard, Kevin, Michaels, and myself. We're honored to be participating this year. Talk to us about the theme of the conference. What are some of the messages folks will be hearing, and how people can, most importantly, I suspect from your standpoint, Brian, how folks can register for it?
Yeah, our theme this year, and this is a 20th anniversary of our conference, we're very excited about it. The theme is Changing Our Flight Plan, Engineering the Road to Recovery. And this conference is going to be all about providing information that helps the executives at the different aerospace companies plan for this next year ahead. And so Ron will be speaking on a panel talking about how financials will impact the aerospace industry. We'll be talking about lessons learned for the companies that have successfully pivoted through this last, you know, 12 months and how you can continue to pivot going forward. And then we'll be hearing from different growth segments, you know, as a lot of these manufacturers are looking, hey, how do I diversify? How do I get into some of these new industries? We're going to be hearing from folks from the space and the autonomous segment, some of the new upcoming technology segments, defense, and so on.
Where can people go to register for the conference?
Go to our website, pnaa.net, and then it will automatically direct you to our conference website. And in the upper right-hand corner, there's a bright red button where you can register for the conference. We've got about a week and a half to go, so you can certainly sign up there. The conference will also have some great features like our B2B fair, where people will be able to connect directly with buyers at 17 different companies, five of them being OEMs, where you can potentially gain new business. We'll have an exhibit hall, a virtual exhibit hall featuring the latest technology and services in the aerospace industry. And there will be lots of networking opportunities. There'll be networking rooms you can go in and have two-way video where you can connect with people and, you know, make your next business relationship. It's a very unique platform. We've pushed technology to the limits to make it feel like you're right there at the conference. It's a lifelike environment. And we look forward to seeing you there. February 8th through 11.
Brian, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Best of luck. I know that planning these things virtual or in person can be a challenge. We wish you the very best. Look forward to joining you at the conference. Thanks very much for joining us. And everybody, thank you for joining us as well. Look forward to having you guys back on next week. Thanks a lot.
As always, Vago, great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much, Vago.
Always great, Vago. Thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again, Vago.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost nine decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.